Welcome to the sixth lecture in the introduction to the 19 letters. And now I'd like to start to give a description of Rav Hirsch, like a short type of biography. Rav Hirsch, he was born in Hamburg on the 24th of Sivan in 1808. And his father's name was Rafal. So it's somewhat of a misnomer to think that Rav Hirsch's name was Shimshon Rafal or Shamshon, depending on who you ask, because Rafal was his father's name. And following a common custom over the time, he took on his father's name for various functions. I believe he used to sign his name that way. Though during the regular weekly life, as far as I understand, Rav Hirsch had a Cholkreish, which is a German custom of having a so-called secular name, and Rav Hirsch was known as Samson, or the German equivalent of that. Just like, for example, Rabbi Yitzchak Dov Halevi, the Wurzburger Rav, was known as Seligman Ber. So anyway, this is a total side point. So Rav Hirsch's father, this Rafal Hirsch, he was a Talmud Chacham, he was a merchant. Rav Hirsch used to say about him that, to my father, Tanakh was a second soul, and who was gifted with a most sensitive perception and clear insight into the beauty and the truths of the holy writings. So we see that this definitely had an effect on Rav Hirsch, because Tanakh to Rav Hirsch, we could also say, was basically a second soul. Now, Rav Hirsch's grandfather was Rav Mendel Frankfurter, and he started a Talmud Torah in Hamburg. He was assistant to the chief rabbi in Altona, and they say that he never accepted any type of reimbursement. He wrote a number of Sfarim. He had a great uncle, who was Rav Lob Frankfurter, also was famous for writing Sfarim. Now, Rav Hirsch's family was from Frankfurt, hence the name Frankfurter. And Rav Hirsch's father, he changed it to Hirsch after his grandfather, so that was Rav Hirsch's great-grandfather, Zvi Hirsch Frankfurter, who he described as a man of pure spirit, pleasant manner, and scrupulous honesty. Rav Hirsch had two Rebbeim, so one was the Chacham Isaac Bernays, Yitzchak Bernays, and Rav Hirsch said that he was a great inspiration on him. Then Rav Hirsch went to learn under the Aruch Lener, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. And like all or many of Rav Yaakov Ettlinger's students, they attended university, as did Rav Hirsch, who went to Bonn University, and he studied philology, types of linguistics about words. He was there for about a year. He never received any kind of degree, and at that point he was hired to be the chief rabbi of Oldenburg, and it was there that he wrote the 19 letters. Just to point out on the side that it was, I mean, today, for people to think that you know, big rabbanim went to college would be, you know, a bit scandalous. But then, certainly, and maybe this is a good or bad, I guess that could be argued, but that this was a common thing in Germany. So Yaakov Ettlinger himself went to college, the university, the Sri Deish, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, all of Hirsch's children, as far as I understand, many of the Breuers, etc. We can go on and on. So that was definitely a common thing of the time. Now, he was invited to bigger and larger communities, Rav Hirsch, and he became a member of the Austrian Parliament. He was chief rabbi over a tremendous area. And in 1851, he accepted a call to the community of Frankfurt, and he built up a major community which was ravaged by reform. And there were only a few families. I've seen different numbers of how many families, but there weren't so many people in this community. And Rav Hirsch saw this as an opportunity to really fulfill his work, to put it into action. Now, Rav Hirsch, what can we say about his personality? So based on people who wrote about him. So they say that people who were not really close with him, they thought he was like kind of cold and remote. He's described as being serious and kind of introverted. And from the first paragraph in his diary, one could see that Rav Hirsch was aware of this at a young age. He was very confident in everything that he did, and he was rarely conciliatory. Like when he knew what he was doing. And to some people, they thought this was an arrogant type of thing. But of course, as this happens with many people, if you don't really know the person, then you have totally a wrong impression. Because from his friends and his family, they describe him as being sensitive and sympathetic, etc. and all these abilities he used when fighting Reform. So I would like to read from the Ars Rho biography, again by Rav Klugman, from Rav Hirsch's diary, and we kind of get a self-portrait from Rav Hirsch about himself and his convictions. And I highly suggest anyone who's interested in Rav Hirsch, they should definitely read this book, because it's excellent. And it's a bit long, but I think it's worth reading through it. So it goes like this. He says, "So it always goes with me when my inner soul is too full. Then it does never the sides as is common in other people. No. Inside there could be stormy, turbulent waves, but on the outside, with pressures and counter-pressures, only silence. I'm like a clock whose inner components interact with each other constantly, but whose hands are missing, so that on the outside it appears completely still. Superficial people hold a feather to the nose and proclaim it lifeless, but those whose comprehension is deeper sense from the ticking that there is indeed life inside. A wise man knows to attach the missing hands to the face, so that he could read the time." In the next paragraph, Rav Hirsch describes that they were on their way from Darmstadt, riding along Bergstrasse, which I believe is a scenic mountain range, and he describes how he is looking around at the forests and the vegetation and the effect that this has on him. And in the next paragraph he writes, "The landscape was full of mirth, and my soul light and joyful along with it. Suddenly, however, my mood plunged, and I groaned inside, saying to myself, 'Look at this. Nature is never lazy. Every plant and bush springs to fulfill the task its creator has set for it. Only man enjoys the prerogative of neglecting his obligations. He is the only one who could disappoint the divine stamp imprinted in him. And what will be of you, Samson? How will you make yourself worthy of the lofty goal to which you aspire in your new path in life? You, who on your native soil neglected more than one of your obligations, and who have now been taken from that soil, and you are on your own, exposed to every passing wind, how can you hope to remain faithful to your heritage and not be deflected from the narrow path of truth? Where will you find a trellis to support your frail stalk when the storms come? Inwardly, I grew increasingly depressed and sat listlessly lost in my thoughts as we passed through the magnificent surroundings. The heat and the monotonous clanging of the wagon wheels had lulled my fellow passengers to sleep, and I too, lost in my ruminations, sank into a semi-dream day in which everything seemed very far away. Then I felt as if someone was tapping me on the shoulder. I turned around involuntarily, and there, never have I seen anyone with such a splendid appearance, and at the same time so filled with friendliness as the person who stood before me. I felt shy and looked at his tall, resolute stature and serious, heroic forehead. Still, his friendly blue eyes and smile that spread precisely from the edges of his mouth inspired in me both awe and trust. Already, the white of age and wisdom graced his face, but his head was not bent over by the burden of his years. The more I gazed at him, the more my depression dissipated. 'What were you depressed about?' he asked in a soft, warm voice, his manner filled with compassion. When I told him the reason for my somberness, he exclaimed, 'For the sake of the Almighty, I would never have thought that someone from your family, and especially you, my dear Samson, would fall prey to despair at such a moment. Many of your forebears have cast a light that can guide you on your way also, and whose support will be yours too. Look around, you and your generation, and select a model for yourself, the person who is most faithful to his heritage.' I sighed and said, 'Is their lot better than mine? And how will I recognize them and choose among them?' 'Come, let us see,' said the old man, and together we floated to the peak of the hill. 'Do you see how they live here?' he continued. 'Everyone has his support. You see the old ones resting there. They seem to be sleeping, with their walking sticks quietly in front of them. Theirs is a good sturdy support, one you could put your weight on, that can guide you. But it's sitting there unused, covered with hundreds of years of dust. You could barely recognize it. Now look over there at those light-headed youngsters dancing about so giddily. Each of them also has a stick, but theirs are just thin rods, mere playthings. When they left their homes, these old men gave each of them one of these sturdy canes. But the arrogant youngsters scorned the sticks so that they could dash away with fast, free steps. They thought the old man's sticks were just useless, heavy encumbrances. "Come, let's get rid of all this useless dust and weight," they said, trying to prance lightly and joyfully. "Look at their sticks now. They might be pretty, but what use are they to them? When they come to the first obstacle and tried to lean on their sticks, the flimsy things broke in their hands, and they stumbled and fell, those frivolous people. Do you see," he continued, "they are the majority. However, look closely and you will see a third group, who stride boldly with their sticks. Their radiant faces reflect the joy in their hearts, and they face their exalted task with calm confidence. They fear no harm. When they were first given their sticks, they set about removing the layers of dust with great care. Now they have uncovered an old luster and they can take pride in that they could take pride in, and they have sticks that give them real support in life. And you, do you understand what that stick is, my Samson? Have you made your choice?" "My choice is firm," I replied. "But I don't really know the nature of this stick," I blushed. "Then you may examine it for yourself," he said, handing me one of the sticks. When I grasped it, my heart pounding fiercely, it unfolded in my hand and became a safer Torah. "Take it," he said, "and it will guide you throughout your life. In the midst of life itself, the Torah will reveal its power to you. And if you ever know someone who desires to take the same step you are asking, you can offer him this support also." Now, Rav Hirsch was an entire 20 years old when he wrote this. You could see definitely throughout that he already understood the plight of Judaism, just from reading this. You see that he definitely was aware of what was happening, and you could see that he was really burdened by this, and that he knew what he needed to do. You see a lot of allusions in this to different parts of Navi, like for example with Zechariah being asked what was happening in vision, and he said he didn't know. Like you could see a lot going on in these words, and it's just written in such a beautiful way. Again, this is in the Art's World Biography, page 36 through 39. In Diane Gernfeld's introduction to Chorev, Rav Hirsch quotes Rav Hirsch, giving a description of the 19th century, and Rav Hirsch's hesitation, which led him to write Chorev, and consequently the 19 letters, as we'll discuss how that happened. So he discusses like two parts, meaning hesitation and action, and I'd like to read that inside. So you can find this in the introduction to Chorev, and he writes like this: 19th century, happy century of light and freedom, how happy are we to walk in thy spirit. You have broken the chain of night, your rays have brought light and life, where night and graves have ruled for millennia. Your most glorious victory you celebrate in contemporary Judaism. Look at Judaism. For centuries it was enchained by the Pharisaic rigidity of outward forms, and tied with the fetters of stupid man-made decrees. In spite of knife and club, in spite of tyranny and oppression, Judaism of old refused to join European civilization. But your soft rays of light, O 19th century, have achieved what oppression and force could never have done. You have melted the thousand-year-old ice of the rigid forms of Judaism. In your spirit, you cast away the chain of Pharisaic interpretation. We ignore the barriers which a medieval spirit set up against life and enjoyment. We shake off the oriental dust of Palestine, and in evening, dress and bow tie, with poetry and logic, aesthetics and dogmatics, with politics and dramatics, we enjoy the new life of Europe. And we even enjoy a diet which we have never tasted before. Yes, we are intoxicated with classical European thought. We drink from the spiritual wells of Greece and Rome. Now, we could become prelates, locksmiths, just as we please. We are no longer the ancient people from Asia, but Britons and Gauls, Belgians and Germans. Century of the Constitution. Judaism, too, has become constitutional. The times are gone when you could legislate for us, O Moses of Egypt. As long as we were underage, you alone had the legislative power. But now, we have come of age. Now your laws are only suggestions. We reject everything that cannot justify itself before the form of our intellect and moral convictions. Our means of power are exegesis and criticism. and the 2,000-year-old fairy tales of tradition have long since ceased to impress or mislead us. It is true that there still exists old fanatics, young hypocrites, who believe they could stay the wheel of time, who would like to turn the convulsion of death of the Judaism of old into the pangs of a new birth, whose rigid mind still finds joy in dead forms and obsolete ceremonies, who try to revive the dead past and would fain extinguish the light of civilization only so recently lit, and who would like to put the people again into the chains of the old rigid law, which they have only just now shaken off under the influence of the spirit of the time. But these old fanatics and young hypocrites will never succeed. Behold, the fight is for light and truth, carrying aloft the torch of critical reason. They hurry along to meet me. They call me to lead them. March on. We are going to storm Talmudical Bastille. And then Rehershi continues to talk about this attacking of tradition. He says, I saw parrots at the head of a crowd, seized like him by wild frenzy, storming on the Lord's house, waving their burning torches. Calm and exalted stood the temple of divine law on the top of the mountain. The mountain itself was crowded from top to bottom with endless rows of all the noblemen who in times gone by, for more than 3,000 years, had lived and died for the divine law, teaching and heeding, doing and fulfilling the words of instruction of God's law, protecting it and fighting for it till the last breath. They saw the frantic crowd, heard their yelling shouts of joy. They recognized the aim of this wild onslaught and sadly bowed their heads and covered their faces. They were used to blows from strangers, from the enemies of their God, their people, and their laws, but they were willing to die and conquer for their people and its spiritual heritage, but not to offer the blushing cheek to the blows of their own sons. They covered their heads in shame, but the crowd stormed on, waving their torches. Mockingly, they singed the heads and robes of the Jewish sages, flung the ancient books upon the stake. The crackling flames devoured them, and the sparks blew heavenwards. The holy temple still stood erect in serene calm, and the crowd would have liked to spare it, but the flames kindled by them had gone beyond their control. A billowing wave of fire covered the temple mount. The heat of the fire forced open the gates of the sanctuary, and in moved the flames which Israel's own sons have kindled. The sanctuary burned down, together with the altar, the holy table, and the curtain. The flames penetrated the Holy of Holies and devoured the tablets of the law. From the mountain of Zion, the wild fire spread through countries and towns, burning to ashes all that was sublime and holy, until the world was a smoking wilderness, until finally the fire had spent itself on a worldwide and desolate scene of conflagration. Thus, the destructive torch kindled by frantic hands, having first been turned against tradition, destroyed God's sanctuary in the end, together with all that was noble and holy in man, and finally, it devoured the torchbearers themselves. As I gazed into the gruesome night, I saw the last flicker of Peretz's torch going up in smoke. Now, this is followed by an opposite type of a vision here. And he writes, it was dawn. The beams of the rising sun shone upon a long row of imposing men clad in shining white robes. They were Israel's elders, judges, prophets, and the men of the great synod, the sages of the Talmud, and the great rabbis of succeeding generations. Leading this elevated assembly was Moshe, our teacher, his face radiant with heavenly splendor. The light that broke forth from Moses' countenance lit the candelabrum, which had miraculously remained intact when the sanctuary burned down. And as the glowing light surrounded the candelabrum, behold, the temple rose again in its serene calm. Altar and table reappeared, and the holy curtain covered once more the Holy of Holies. The divine law rested again in the ark, protected by the Kerubim of the Lord. The earth was again filled with joy and blessing, and behold, Moshe, our teacher, approached me and said, how could you hesitate, my son, as you saw the struggle of delusion against truth, of man against God? Human arrogance and lack of insight had removed heaven from earth, had called my work that which was in reality the work of God, and had described the loyal messengers of the divine word deceivers and impostors, and you could hesitate inactively even for a moment. And Rav Hirsch, when he wrote this, again you could see his his intense conviction in that he knew what he was doing and he knew the exact situation of what was happening. So I hope this gives a pretty good idea of who Rav Hirsch was, a little bit about him, and some of his personality. And we will continue next time discussing some more specifics about what Rav Hirsch has done